You are at work today. That's the good news. It went down to the wire, but Congress managed to get that continuing resolution passed. It lasts until December 16th, and for what comes after that, and in the meantime, we turn to Bloomberg Government Congress reporter Jack Fitzpatrick. And Jack, I guess they went to the deadline. Tell us more about that CR and what else Congress is going to be up to.
Yes. Unsurprisingly, Congress waited until almost the last minute to fund the government. They have a tendency to do that, but it never really seemed like anybody was going to sincerely shut down. As soon as they got agreement to pull Joe Manchin's energy permitting bill from this stopgap and maybe try to do that on something else, it looked like they had a good path forward to fund the government. So this goes through December 16th. There will be an attempt to do a lame duck deal on a full government funding omnibus bill. Between now and then, the first thing they have to do to accomplish that is get a bipartisan, bicameral agreement on what the basic numbers are going to be. They need to settle the just general, what's the number going to be on defense and non-defense discretionary spending? And they will probably try to pair that with some sort of broad agreement on, are we going to allow a bunch of policy riders or not? Once they get the general framework, they can move pretty quickly to put together an omnibus, but that will be the big challenge. Republicans want a big increase for defense, and for many years they've talked about, well, you increase defense, you get Republican votes, you increase non-defense, you get Democratic votes. Republicans are trying to make a push to say this should not be parity. They should increase it more for defense than non-defense. We'll see how that goes, but that's going to be a conversation over the next few weeks while they're gone, as conversations among the top appropriators to see if they can get a general framework that would then enable a real funding deal.
Right. And there is some pressure on the military that is trying to help out Ukraine. And, you know, the latest delivery under that funding to Ukraine may not be available for a couple of years, 3-4 years, the actual equipment. That's what the Pentagon says. And therefore, they might have to draw down U.S. stocks. Nobody knows how that's going to play out yet. But could that be a factor in those negotiations?
That is definitely a factor in the talks. The attempts and the need to refill the U.S. military stocks because they have relied on their own material to aid Ukraine because that's much faster. And because the U.S. is not itself actively at war with anybody, but obviously the military, even former people, Mark Esper, the Trump administration's defense secretary, was telling a colleague of mine that you need to act very quickly to increase U.S. defense spending in order to gradually refill your weapons, ammunition, other material, because it is a slow process. The federal government does not move extremely fast. So there is a push right now to say we need a bigger than usual defense funding increase, partly because of the aid to Ukraine that has added up to a lot, but also just because of inflation. If you're going to try to get, you know, the conversation now is a 4.6% pay raise for members of the military. If you're going to try to do that and also increase their capabilities, and you're looking at much higher percentage inflation, depending on what month you're looking at, high rates of inflation lately, you don't want to decrease the military's purchasing power. So those are two main factors that are leading Republicans to push very hard for big defense numbers. Democrats have indicated some willingness to go there. The question is, do they also then get a corresponding increase for other agencies as well?
Right. I guess the arsenal of democracy can be a little creaky at times.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Jack Fitzpatrick. He's Congress reporter for Bloomberg Government. And what about the factor of, as you mentioned, this negotiation will take place in the lame duck, but what if there is a switch in party dominance in one or both of the chambers that will be coming after these negotiations? How could that affect it?
That will clearly have some effect. They're going to look at the results of the election and try to get a deal before the next Congress, just because there's no reason to wait, no particular reason. But obviously, if Republicans take at least the House, if not also the Senate, they're going to feel bolstered in the demands that they're making. Now, there is a group of Republicans, the Freedom Caucus and other conservatives, who have said, we shouldn't have this stopgap to December. We should just kick it to the next Congress when we assume we will have at least the House on the Republican side. And when we have more votes, we should vote then on a funding deal. The appropriators and the maybe more compromise-minded Republicans have said, look, you're going to need a Democrat's signature in the White House. You're going to need 60 votes in the Senate. It's not going to make that much of a difference. We might as well try to get this done in December. And if you want to sort of factor the results of the election into those negotiations, you can. And if you don't get a good deal, you can always wait. So it seems there are enough Republicans interested in getting a December deal so that it is possible they could come together and find something to get 60 votes in the Senate. But if things get off to a rocky start, there is a vocal portion of the Republican Party saying, let's kick it at least to January, if not later, because we think we'll have more leverage then.
Right. So federal agencies themselves, then, it could be a while before they get the funding for 2023 and whatever new programs and initiatives they wish to launch.
Right. There is a possibility this does not come together in December. When you hear that December 16th date, you know, keep in mind Congress often treats the last Friday before Christmas as the real deadline because that's when they want to get out of there. So even if things go well, they could make it to December 16th and then need another few days or another week. And it's possible that if they struggle on that and the conservatives sort of win the argument that they should wait later and wait for themselves to have more votes in whichever chamber they control, it's not impossible to see another CR take this into March. And in fact, the appropriators I've talked to, people like Tom Cole, who say they want a deal, have said, look, if we keep kicking this down the road, we're going to end up with a full year CR. So that's a reason to try for a deal in December, but they cannot stand here right now and say there's absolutely going to be a deal. They can't even entirely rule out the possibility of a full year CR. So there is some lack of certainty in all of this.
And also bouncing around somewhere in there is the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yes, there was a plan to actually sincerely try to work on that in October ahead of the midterms. Now that has turned into a couple key senators are going to come in. They're probably going to speak on the floor. They may announce some sort of timing agreement, but there's not going to be a vote or, you know, a conference between the House and Senate that really gets them toward the finish line on the defense authorization until the lame duck. That will factor in. It's not the same series of negotiations as appropriations, but that conversation about what will the defense top line number be, that will be a dominating factor of the lame duck session, is trying to get the defense authorization bill done and actually to the president's desk then, as well as figuring out the appropriations side. So they briefly flirted with trying to do some stuff more on that before the midterms, but that looks like a lame duck series of conversations now.
Because that one, they informally give themselves the deadline of the calendar year, and that they've never missed. So there's that incentive to get that done maybe after the lame duck, but before New Year's.
Yes, there is a sincere push to get that across the finish line in the lame duck. And I think we can count on a lot of work being done on the defense authorization bill and appropriations in the November-December lame duck. That's when they have treated as the effective deadline for both of those. And, you know, they are not at the finish line now, but that will be sort of the dominant focus for that lame duck session, is those two major bills.
Jack Fitzpatrick is Congress reporter at Bloomberg Government. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Podcast One or wherever you get your shows.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. After an exemplary career as a former executive at the FBI focused on policy and strategy, Sasha O'Connell, PhD, is guiding future federal leaders as the executive in residence in the School of Public Affairs at American University. Sasha joins host Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA, to discuss her exciting career, the future of the federal workforce, and the lessons she's learned along the way.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA, and today I'm thrilled to be joined by Sasha O'Connell. Sasha is an executive in residence in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at the School of Public Affairs at American University, and spent the majority of her career at the FBI, and most recently as the organization's chief policy advisor, science and technology, and the section chief of office and policy for the FBI's deputy director. Sasha, welcome.
Jane, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Can you give us an example of someone early in your career that motivated you, and then and how did what did that look like?
Sure, absolutely. So it sounds almost cliche, but it was the dining room table. So I grew up with a stepfather who spent 30 years at the Veterans Administration at the VA, and he talked at the dinner table. He started as a social worker and then sort of rose up into management, administration, and leadership. And his stories, right, and his approach really, really impacted me. My mom, interestingly, ended up in a career in public service. She was a prosecutor. She's currently a retired state superior court judge. But she had a big career change also in her 40s. She went back to law school in her 40s. So getting all of that in the mix at a young age at the dinner table really, really impacted me in really specific ways.
Yeah, that's amazing. My father was part of the generation that took President Kennedy's call to action. And he took that to heart, and he went and worked at the Department of Interior and a number of other places in federal service. So it's catching when you're around it. You've held a number of leadership roles at the FBI, which is historically a male-dominated organization. What skills or traits helped you most as you navigated that?
Yeah, it's such a it's an interesting and challenging sort of situation and question. One, I don't think I still am reflecting on it. I've been out of the FBI about 6 years, and I'm sort of still thinking about it. I think the bottom line was when I was there, and I really grew up there, I didn't know any different. I grew up with male cousins and brothers, and, you know, it was sort of a continuation of my existence. So it did, you know, in retrospect, it was a really unique situation, but it didn't necessarily feel that way for me at the time. I think staying mission-focused, staying not about me, staying flexible in terms of problem-solving all helped me. I will say there's resources today that weren't there when I was there, or certainly when I was starting out. There's a lot of affinity groups for women in national security, women in federal law enforcement. And I will say I think I would have really benefited from access to those kind of resources as I was coming up. I had both incredible mentors, men and women, women across the organization who I became very close with, who were incredible supports, not just getting the job and starting out, but sort of matriculating through. But again, I'm really sort of proud of, involved in some of the work of those external organizations that bring women across government, executive women in government, and those kind of organizations together, because I think it is really, really helpful as one moves through.
Yeah, we actually work with a number of those, too, and go to their events and conferences and support them because it's important. How has your leadership style developed or changed over the years?
Well, I think I've gotten a little more confident in it, right? The seeds were there at that dining room table. One thing that carried through that I learned from my stepdad was to focus on the process. He would talk at dinner about big ideas or big changes and how to get from here to there. Was part of his day job, and he thought about explicitly, was getting other people on board, getting that stakeholder engagement, getting other people to think it was their idea if that was required. And that's something I started out with as a gift, right, that kind of approach. And then I got confidence in that, and then I added things. I will say, as I moved on, my appreciation for taking care of is maybe the wrong word, but really focusing on the people who work with you and for you in some instances, you know, making sure that they have what they need to be successful in a tactical way. But then also something I definitely learned at the FBI as I went along is, you know, the importance of creating an environment that is supportive and inspiring. You know, we joke about it, but food has played a pretty serious role in my leadership style over time. I learned from great mentors. I worked with Bill Estevez at the FBI, who had a full-scale cappuccino maker at his cubicle, right, and would host coffee hour, and you'd see the steam rising across the cubicles. I worked with a great friend who used to carry hot frittatas for breakfast celebrations or on the metro, right, in one of those sort of coolie bags. And so I think it's been additive in terms of learning, gaining confidence in my approach, and then adding these pieces as I go that I've certainly learned from mentors and colleagues.
And clearly you never let anything get in your way. You were mission focused, as you mentioned, and you just got the job done no matter what was in front of you.
Well, I wish, Shane, it was that easy. I mean, I think we had a lot of success. One thing has always been my approach when starting out as a leader, too, is to solve near-term problems. I always say sort of deliver short and then you can push them long, right? So we don't always succeed in those long-term goals or those, you know, sort of blue sky ideas as leaders we want to achieve. But we deliver on those short-term pieces, right? And you get that buy-in from those stakeholders. And then often you can push toward those bigger dreams, hopes, aspirations, and goals. I would like to say I was 100% on both fronts. I'm not sure your characterization is 100% accurate there, but I'll take it in this sense.
Looking back, what's one piece of advice you might have given your younger self when you first started?
Yeah, it's interesting today, too, working with students, I get that chance, right, to give my younger self advice every day. And one thing we talk a lot about, and I wish I had thought more explicitly about, is really, it's about calibration, right? And so I always think Emeril Lagasse would say, like, a stove has dials for a reason, right? It's not like all hot or all cold. And I think it's the same here. In some ways, in my career, I had to learn to tone it down, right? And to, you know, certainly at the FBI, sometimes you need to take that back seat at a meeting and wait to be invited to the table. And that's really the appropriate way to build rapport, relationships, and trust. Other times, I needed to learn to tune it up, right? To up the volume a little bit. I had a wonderful boss, Dave Schellendorf, who we were in a meeting together with big bosses at the FBI once, and I was working for Dave. And we left the meeting and we were walking back to the office, and I made a point. I don't even remember what the point was now. And he stopped in the hall and said, "Why didn't you say that in the meeting? You're not helping me, right? Telling me this now, I have to go back and fix this." And I realized, so, well, sometimes you have to tone it down, sometimes you have to tone it up, and that modulation, that sort of volume control about when to lean in and out, if you will, that's, you know, even just thinking about that explicitly for folks starting out, I think is really helpful because it's not one size fits all.
Right. I totally agree and understand that. It isn't one size fits all, and a lot of leadership is described in bumper stickers, sayings, and I don't think that's realistic. I think it's situationally dependent, and you have to be self-aware and aware of your circumstances to adjust. That's well said. You're training the next generation, or helping to train them, federal leaders through AU's School of Public Affairs. How do you encourage young people to answer the call of federal service?
You know, I'm so lucky at AU. We draw in, right, students who are primed for this and who are passionate when they walk in our doors. Even with that population, you know, there are headwinds, right? USA jobs, right? Just even getting educated, these pieces. So helping with that is a whole set of work. I'm also really passionate about, as you point out, reaching out to a diversity of folks who haven't even thought about these careers as careers. I had a conversation with a young woman the other day, and she was talking about law school. I'm fully supportive of law school, and I said, "Have you ever thought about a career in federal service?" And she said, "Isn't that for old people?" I said, okay. So, you know, I mean, there's an education to do, right? Clearly, she's never seen the softball leagues, you know, down in the mall or kickball or any of the fun we all have in town, where we certainly did when we were younger. But I really try, again, podcasts like this and other venues to put myself out there and really talk about what it's like, the opportunities I had at the FBI to be in the middle of the mission space and to explain that the federal government needs all kinds of skills, right, and diversity of thought, right, and diversity of people. So there's that sort of working with the group that's primed for us, and we need to help them get over those barriers, get in, and then stay and stay engaged and passionate. And then there's reaching those new audiences. And there's a lot of work both places, but it's a lot of fun to work with young folks who are passionate about it. So I'm really lucky in my current job.
And career civil service is a great path if somebody wants to take it. Our board is 100% SES level career civil servants. They are all dedicated. They have a real passion for what they're doing. They could go work anywhere, but they choose federal service.
And there's no place, I always tell young folks who ask me about it, there's no place you're going to get the level of responsibility quickly as you do in federal service, right? And yes, sometimes things move slow. It's supposed to move slow, right? We talk about the reasons for that too. But there's really no other industry, maybe some startups you might get this experience, but really where you can be in the middle of mission space, whether you're passionate about the environment or national security or healthcare, you know, public health, and you're going to get in there quickly, and you're going to get in the mix and get exposure, experience, and opportunity for impact that's really unlike any other career.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Sasha, and thanks to everyone for listening. I'm Shane Canfield, and this has been the Lessons in Leadership podcast. Talk to you next time.
Reconnect with a carpool or vanpool. Even if you're commuting just a few days a week, Commuter Connections can match you with others that live and work near or at the same place as you. Prefer taking the bus or train? There's never been a better time to reconnect with transit. Plus, you have the added comfort of knowing Guaranteed Ride Home is there for any unexpected emergency. For free. For more options, visit commuterconnections.org or call 1-800-745-RIDE. Some restrictions apply.
Whether it's Baker's Simple Truth Turkey or mac and cheese with Murray's English Cheddar or pie made with fresh Cosmic Crisp apples, there are many dishes we look forward to sharing during the holidays. And Baker's has all the fresh ingredients you need to turn today's holidays into tomorrow's memories. Baker's, fresh for everyone.
Get more ways to save at the Buy 5 or More Save $1 Each sale. Just buy 5 or more participating items and save $1 each with card. Baker's, fresh for everyone.